Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the politics of Muslim Americans and how might they be changing in the current political environment? But first, greenwashing culture. How journalism, the entertainment industry, and museums impact the environment. With us is Toby Miller. He's a professor of media and the author of 29 books, including Greenwashing Culture. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. Toby, it's great to have you back here with us.
Thanks so much, Maria. Great to be with you.
And what a fantastic new book about culture and greenwashing. I had originally planned to start with the way you started the book with this public relations firm, Edelman. But I think what we should do is talk about culture first and what exactly you mean when you talk about culture. How can we understand it and its effects on society?
How much time do you have? So I guess there are normally two ways in which people conceive of culture, Maria. One would be anthropological or ethnographic, and that is, in a sense, the way in which we live our lives, the way in which when you and I wait for a bus in L.A., we know that we have to stand in line, and we know that the person at the front of the line gets on the bus first. All of those things through to, you know, even more mundane elements, but that are quite important, like how you lay a table, where you put the knife and the fork, how these things are agreed, how we learn them, how we organize our daily rituals, that when we go to church or when we're in class, we don't just start speaking whenever we feel like it. We wait until others have spoken and asked for us to speak. That kind of question is addressed by that form of culture. And then there's the more aesthetic or artistic form of culture, which is where those ritualistic norms of daily life are inscribed. So, for example, when we read romance fiction, a Harlequin novel, or a Milton Boone novel, depending on where you are, or a money, sex, power novel with raised writing on the paperback cover, if you still read paperbacks, then we learn about heterosexual mating rituals. And that's done with a particular style that's determined by the genre, by the publisher, by the language, by the kind of readership. Now, as you can see, the distinction I'm drawing between the anthropological and the aesthetic breaks down because, of course, when we read the Harlequin or Milton Boone novel or the money, sex, power novel with the raised writing on the cover, that novel is both addressing the kind of everyday norms of ritual and it is also textualizing them and teaching them. So the anthropological and the aesthetic come together. When that happens, for example, in the form of a museum, the museum or the art gallery is both offering us norms about how to comport ourselves as visitors to a museum and ideas about history or behavior at the same time as it is creating aesthetic understandings about architecture, about beauty, and about truth.
So in a way, it's sort of conveying an ideology as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that ideology, particularly, say, in the space of a museum, is all about, or can be about, how things in the past should be understood, but we've transcended them and now we're somewhere else. I mean, if you think about the current controversy in the US over the tearing down of statues commemorating the Confederacy, I was living in New Orleans for the first half of this year and was present when one of those statues was removed. That is about trying to say we have a past which we have transcended, and then the issue becomes, do you want to celebrate the loss of that past or do you want to criticize it? So there are very definite ideological components, absolutely.
And so when you wrote this book, one of the theorists that you spent some time on, actually a few of them, were Antonio Gramsci and the Frankfurt School. They argued that the culture industry is a force of anti-enlightenment or mass deception. And then you kind of sprang from there into more present-day theory. Do you agree with them about the anti-enlightenment mass deception of those theorists, or do you think that it's evolved to another stage?
That's a really great question. All your questions are great and quite penetrating. I want to sit on the fence and have a bit each way. Basically, what Adorno and Horkheimer in the Dialectic of the Enlightenment were saying was that regardless of content, the industrialized form of manufacturing culture, which they encountered when they moved to Santa Monica during the war, was creating movies and radio programs in the same way that Detroit was manufacturing cars. In other words, that there was a standardized norm that allowed for a certain amount of difference in order to differentiate different radio shows or Hollywood movies, but that this relied very much on a standard mode of production with minimal disruption to techniques and minimal innovation, and that that was the enemy of what they saw as the great task and gift of the Enlightenment in Kantian terms, namely, and obviously this takes you down the path of German philosophy, the task of making us reconsider ourselves as projects, taking critical distance from ourselves to see who we really are, holding up what might be an unflattering glass to ourselves and saying, I or we as a nation or this family could be better if we did the following things. But that great task of the Enlightenment and of culture was being done in by industrialized modes. Now, as I've indicated with reference to, for example, romance fiction or the money, sex, power novel with Ray's writing on the cover, I don't think that that highly industrialized model necessarily fails to encourage us to engage in critical self-reflection. And lots of ethnographic studies of things like romance fiction have shown that for many heterosexual women readers, the great gift of this kind of cultural production, however industrialized and quasi-uniform it may be, is that when it comes to conversation about their lives, readers of this material, the same thing applies to lots of self-help writing, manage then to take that kind of story, be it fictional or pop psychological, and allow it to become a measuring stick against their own lives. Dissatisfaction at the lack of love in their heterosexual relationships, the dissatisfaction at male-female roles, all kinds of things. So yes, I think Adorno and Horkheimer were really onto something when they alerted us to the need to look at what happens when you industrialize culture and manufacture it in the same way as an automobile. But no, I think they were wrong in suggesting that as a consequence, the products, the texts of that kind of culture industry necessarily negate our capacity to engage in critical self-reflection.
Let's turn to your main thesis of the most current book, which is greenwashing. And you spent quite a bit of time documenting and reiterating how much trouble we're in as a planet and how much we're contributing to the destruction of this planet, simultaneous with the greenwashing of the culture industry, so to speak, movies, journalism, museums. Maybe we need to talk about the effects first of the film and TV industry, journalism, and museums. What is the environmental impact?
Well, let's start by saying that most of us would probably assume, as did I until about 15 years ago, that these were comparatively green sectors, by contrast, say, with mineral extraction or aerospace or transportation by car or lots and lots of other manufacturing and extractive industries, and even probably agriculture. And in fact, lots of these sectors advertise themselves as green. And when you see post-industrial societies trying to remake themselves, they often talk about how there will be a green future as they move towards the service or ternary sector, which includes things like the areas you've just mentioned. However, that's not the case. For example, there's a very powerful study of Los Angeles, and how within that city, one that is notably polluted by the vast use of automobiles on an everyday basis and trucks and so on, actually in terms of contribution to pollution, the film industry and the television industry, the production end of things, is a greater contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in Los Angeles than transportation. And if you look at the museum sector, you see that one of the things that lots of museums do, whether it's the Tate Modern in London or the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in California, is that they engage in two kinds of greenwashing. The first is that they provide an alibi, one might ironically call it a smokescreen, for major polluters like, say, BP or Shell, in both those cases, who draw upon the goodwill given to them in the public mind by sponsoring blockbuster exhibits or buildings at those famous museums in order to appear as though they are benign entities, part of their search for what they call the social license to operate, so that beyond having commercial and state rights to drill, for example, they also have public acquiescence to do so. At the same time as frequently the museums themselves engage in polluting activity. It can mean, for example, Google searches that are undertaken by administrators and conservators at the museums. Most Google searches are undertaken not necessarily by Google's element itself, but by those who are using it through coal-powered technology. So there's a very dirty coal element to much of our online work that we do. And also because, for example, if you're putting on a major dinner for big donors, then not only are you inviting them using technologies that are very dirty, but, for example, lots of them, and I've witnessed this myself at the Art Institute of Chicago, for example, have their chauffeurs idling the limousines for 4 or 5 hours so they can leave whenever they feel like it, as they prepare to sign or not sign the hefty checks that museums are hoping to receive. So there are all those factors that are at play. There's both the question in the museum sector of providing cover for greenwashing and doing your own greenwashing. When it comes to journalism, there are, on the one hand, certainly the kinds of impacts that come from all the one click away lies all of truth elements of contemporary journalism, where instead of pounding the street in rubber soles to interview people and actually find stuff out in person, many, many journalists are relying entirely on the internet without any sense of how clean and green their own form of energy is, or that of the various routes that the internet takes us on as it speeds around the world to find stuff out and communicate it. And also there are various aspects of journalism that are innately involved in pollution. A famous and very important one is travel journalism. Probably all of us have enjoyed some very good articles by some excellent writers, for example, in the New York Times, about what it's like to go to a certain tourist destination, perhaps even an eco-tourist destination. But of course, what happens is that those writers generally have their airfares paid by the tourism entities that are trying to attract the coverage. They rarely include the carbon imprint of their own journalism, nor do they generally include such issues in the coverage that they provide us with. If you look at all the major journalism federations and unions around the world, even those that themselves are dedicated to reporting on the environmental impact of different industries, rarely engage in any kind of audit of their own carbon footprint. So those are some of the ways in those three sectors you mentioned that I think there's a real problem that needs to be addressed. And it's a problem that isn't obvious to us. We tend to assume, certainly I did, that these are very, very green sectors. To the extent that we know, they're really not.
You actually laid out quite a bit of the environmental destruction within this book, you know, talking about, for example, the health effects of the plastics and wires and monitors that are smashed and dismantled, and this informal economy of rag pickers. How can you help us understand how all of this accumulates and what it really means?
Take a place like Australia, and it, of course, has about 23 million people. It has more than 23 million disposed of cell phones, or mobile phones, as they call them there. One of the problems that a lot of us face in terms of the technologies that you and I and our colleagues at the station are using today is that we're used to the idea that these large or small gadgets work, and then suddenly they don't and they have to be disposed of. What we're not used to is that they have polluting components, A, at the level of the extraction of minerals to create them, B, at the level of their manufacture, C, at the level of our use, and D, in terms of their post-consumer life. What do I mean by that? Some folks may be aware of the fact that central processing units rely, inter alia, on coltan, which is a composite mineral that basically comes from Democratic Republic of Congo, which, as listeners will be aware, is the site of a horrendous civil war in which millions have died and many more have been raped and injured. A lot of those deaths, a lot of those violations have occurred as part of the conflict minerals industry, which is how the coltan that's in the middle of the cell phone that I'm holding now to my ear to speak to you with is powered in part. So there, and in addition to those human costs, there is a massive impact on the local environment when it comes to pollution of water, air, and earth as a consequence of that extractive work. So there's one example. Another example is at the point of manufacturing. The world's biggest television manufacturer is Mexico, closely followed by China and Vietnam. They basically corner the market. And because Mexico is a democracy, we know a lot more about the experiences of those working in it than we do in the two other nation states. In Mexico, there is extraordinary pollution in the maquiladoras, just south of the border with the United States, at the point where television sets are created. Then, of course, they come over the border. Let's stick with TVs again for a moment. One of the things about the beautiful new flat-screen digital TVs is that they are energy hogs, and they are also quite hot. So in addition to the energy that they use, which is decreasing as the manufacturers become more concerned about such matters, they also encourage many viewers, without thinking about the fact, to be, for example, increasing their use of air conditioning or their use of fans in order to cool the houses and other places in which they're watching the television. Then when a new model comes along, what happens? Well, when we got rid of our old flat screen analogic TVs, where did the hundreds and hundreds of millions, almost 300 million in the US alone, go? Well, they went to West Africa, to Latin America, to Southeast Asia, illegally in most cases, where they were ripped apart, normally by rag pickers, whom you mentioned earlier, i.e. people in the informal sector, in search of the dozens of valuable minerals within them, but without adequate protection against the health risks created to them as informal recyclers by the carcinogenic gases and other properties that are within them. In addition to the horrendous health impact on those people, in addition to all the immediate effects, there are later effects caused from the fact that parts of these recycled television sets, and the same applies to computers and to cell phones and to tablets, are then either buried, in which case they leach into the water table and pollute the soil, or they're burnt, in which case they do the same to the air. So the long-term environmental impacts, as well as the short, medium, and long-term occupational health and safety impacts, are horrendous. Most of us don't think about any of those phases when we engage in the pleasure or the work necessity of utilizing these gadgets. And what we need to do is appreciate that although they may be crucial parts of our lives in terms of family fun or sports enjoyment or going out for the weekend or doing our jobs, they wreak terrible havoc in ways that we can neither see nor hear, but are affecting very materially our lives, our futures, and especially the lives of those in the global south who create the conditions of possibility for our pleasure and our work necessity, and then take responsibility for doing away with them when they've played their part for us.
So let's turn to possible solutions. You argue for a green citizenship, turning more towards a deep ecology where we don't just center on human, we sort of center on the whole picture with the human within it. You see, this is bigger than the nation state. It's got to be supranational. So how would you see this as a possible way of addressing these pretty awful consequences?
One is supposed to end with positive remarks and optimism for the future. You mentioned Gramsci earlier, and he's, of course, famous for many things, not the least of which is quoting Romain Rolland, the French Nobel laureate, who wrote about pessimism of the intelligence, optimism of the will. So this is often wrongly attributed to Gramsci, and the word intelligence is changed to intellect. And one needs both those things. One needs to be looking at the downsides with a serious analytic scrutiny, at the same time as one looks at ways around the problem. And I guess my 25 years living in the United States imbued me a little more with the hopefulness of a Gramsci, as opposed to the horrendous pessimism that my early childhood left me with, by which I simply mean being a teenage Marxist in other countries. So enough of my exciting autobiography. What would this mean? Well, it means recognizing that the stereotype of the environmentalist as the white guy, shaggy-haired, you know, full-bearded, non-hipster, alienated subject who wanders around hugging trees and doesn't connect to issues to do with public policy or commerce or consumption or ordinary people's lives is actually quite wrong. The very significant longitudinal and latitudinal studies of membership of green movements, mostly done in the US, shows that they are cross-class, cross-race, and very cross-geographical. And if you think about some of the ideological objections to environmentalism, you see that it's really a false bifurcation that places environmentalists amongst radicals and anti-environmentalists amongst conservatives. If we turn back the pages to Edmund Burke and his famous negative reflections on the revolution in France in the 18th century, Burke, in objecting to the revolution in France, made one of the most famous remarks that has become a cornerstone of environmental discourse, namely that we have a duty to protect our world, both for our children and for those yet to be born. And that's a long-term conservative tradition. Now, it's warped in the United States by the self-interest of a number of extremely wealthy and powerful corporations and families. But there is a way in which both conservatives and progressives can find common cause in the notion of shepherding our world so that it can be enjoyed and remade by others. So that's one positive note. Another positive note is that there, in addition to being a potentially broad coalition, and certainly already a much broader analytic base to environmentalism than we thought, there are some extremely significant moments in the work of non-government organizations, multinational corporations, and states that show the capacity for cooperation across their very different forms of life. To give an example, when it comes to the issues with television sets and telephones and computers that I mentioned, every year Greenpeace puts out a really superb study by its own scientists, often with the cooperation of major corporations, into the green claims and realities of a lot of these gadgets. Similarly, groups involved in militancy in Hong Kong over the working conditions and occupational health and safety of those assembling a lot of our gadgets has been extremely effective in bringing international attention to bear on companies like Foxconn that embark on these kinds of quasi-slave manufacturing protocols. And although the United States is an outlier in the terms of its current administration and that administration's atrocious record on environmentalism, the previous president of France said not long before leaving office, this was François Hollande, we can no longer think of everyday life as a commodity. We have to think of it as something that we look after for the future. So there really are some significant examples abroad of many, many companies, NGOs, and states that are seeking to behave in more responsible ways than we have been used to. There is hope. There is possibility. There is the prospect of a better future.
There were two Latin American examples that you gave ways of approaching that might be worth considering. One was in Ecuador, the Constitution.
That's right, the Ecuadorian Constitution. And remember, this is a state that for the first time has seen significant power given by the electorate to Indigenous peoples in the recent past, recognizes the Earth, Mother Earth, and it's gendered in that way, as having rights, as requiring constitutional protections in the same way as free speech or immigration or citizenship rights or rights to cultural expression are granted in many other constitutions. That's a really compelling and powerful notion of how we can hold governments to account in the new kind of constitutional world of environmental citizenship. The other example to which you refer is from Colombia, which is where I work 12 weeks of the year and where I am now. Bogota, which is, of course, the capital, very big city, has for years been maintained informally by the aforementioned ragpickers. These are mostly people who are analphabetic, i.e. they can neither write nor read. Some of them are indigenous and may not speak Spanish, which, of course, is the official and dominant language of the nation state. And so we're always excluded from opportunities to bid for the contracts to be the official cleaners of the city. After some fellow travelers from the left and amongst feminism, because most of these informal workers are women, got together and created a legal challenge to that exclusion that says, well, you can't read or write, so you can't sign a contract. The Supreme Court here ultimately decided in their favor. And so they were able to cut in on the contracts that traditionally had been given to the sons and daughters, particularly the sons of the traditional light-skinned oligarchy that still runs this country. And rank pickers are often the most powerless of the most powerless. I gave examples of people who are picking away at the remains of gadgets. But in addition to that, these people are often stereotyped by otherwise good entities like the World Health Organization and other public health researchers and officials as problems because of the huge amount of really dangerous diseases that they suffer from and therefore the costs they impose on public health. They are rarely seen as solidarity entrepreneurs working together for the common good. And that example is an instance of where, along with some fantastic organization of indigenous ragpickers led by Brazilians, but involving people from South Asia, from Southeast Asia and other parts of the world, have seen how they have common cause and can utilize democratic claims in order to better their situation. So again, as you imply, there is real hope and there has been real progress made by them in terms of being able to dynamize and animate environmental citizenship.
The book again is Greenwashing Culture, and Toby Miller is our guest. He's a distinguished professor of media and culture studies. Well, thank you so much for joining us here again on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for giving me this great opportunity.
When we come back, the politics of Muslim Americans. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What are the politics of Muslim Americans, and how might they be changing under the current political environment? With us is Emily Curry-Toma. She's a research fellow at Northeastern University's Middle East Center. And Aubrey Westfall. She's a professor of political science at Wheaton College. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. You're doing research in a fascinating new area. Political scientists have really failed to look at the politics of Muslim Americans. So why don't we start there? Why this absence, do you think?
I think there are a couple reasons. The first is that I think we don't have a great handle on how big the population is in the United States because we don't collect data on religious affiliation in the census. And of course, Muslims have all sorts of overlapping identities. So they are also racial minorities or not. And so when we think about identity politics with Muslims, it's complex and it's multifaceted.
Precisely. And I think that most people became aware of the American Muslim community post 9/11, of course. So they went from being this sort of invisible community to a very visible American minority. So I think that has had both positive and negative consequences for the Muslim American community. And we're seeing it again with the current election cycles, where they've become a very visible minority group.
But visible for a different set of reasons than what you are advocating that we need to be looking at.
Yes, visible for a different set of reasons, mostly from the perspective of threat. That's the framework in which Muslim Americans have become visible in the minds of most Americans.
In fact, those of us who work on American Muslim politics are very excited about the new Pew Research Survey, which was just released in July of this year. And it tells us a little more about this story that we're trying to sort of examine, right? Muslim Americans, and in particular during these election cycles. And what we know from that survey is that the great majority of them perceive a great sense of threat. And this threat is both constructed by elites who have made Muslims a focus of elections. Also, there's a wide variety of media representations plays a role. Elite discourse, as I just said, and social and political queuing.
Yes, and foreign policy, too.
Yeah, so Aubrey Westphal, you mentioned earlier about the complexity. I mean, it's almost like saying Christian Americans, because there's so many different ethnic identities within Christian Americans, but there's also all of these different factions within Christianity. And so it's hard to just see Muslim Americans
as a monolith.
Exactly.
Yes, they're not a monolith. It's the most diverse minority group that we have in the United States. Right. And of course, within the Muslim faith, there's also great diversity, denominational diversity, diversity in terms of how devout or how dogmatic your belief system is, and also the cultural practices and the way that those cultural practices translate into their faith practice is different.
And in their politics.
And in their politics.
Which is what you were working on, is like, what about the politics? Mm-hmm. So what about the identity formation, for example? It's not a monolith, but is there a Muslim American identity that does have cohesion? Emily? That's
a really excellent question, and it's one that I try to begin tapping into in my own work. I look at the role of Muslim American interest groups, organizations, because I think that they are playing a very important role in communicating this sort of unified identity. I'll go back to the point I made in the beginning, that I think post 9/11 threat has given this community a sort of communal aspect, and that matters. In addition to what Aubrey said just briefly, 58% of American Muslims are first-generation Americans, and about 18% or so are second-generation Americans. So they're a largely immigrant group as well, and this matters when we think about their political incorporation, their political participation. Citizenship rates are very high, so 80% of Muslims are U.S. citizens, and that's great. However, not all of them are registered to vote, right?
So, what percent do you know is registered to vote?
I think it's about 60%.
So it's about the same as the rest of America.
They actually look very much like ordinary Americans in their political behavior. And that's what my work actually shows. I've done some work on Muslim American identity and on political participation. And one of the main themes of the work is that Muslim Americans are Americans. Mm-hmm. They behave just like Americans in almost every respect. Their identities are a little different. One of the most interesting things about the Muslim American and the Muslim groups internationally is that they do strive for the creation of a cohesive community globally. My co-authors and I, in our forthcoming manuscript, argue that the American Muslim community is a microcosm for the creation of this diverse global Muslim community. And we look at how the headscarf in particular becomes a vector through which Muslim Americans can identify each other within this diverse community, and a symbol around which they can unify and participate.
Although it's not necessarily unifying because not everybody wears one.
No, and not everyone wears it the same way.
Right.
Different cultural groups wear their headscarves very differently.
And then there is, of course, when you look at foreign policy, which you mentioned, mm-hmm. and lobbying mm-hmm. on foreign policy, so much of the divisions overseas mm-hmm. are dividing Muslims. So how do they lobby on these issues?
Yeah. Well, I would argue that, in fact, we see that some of the foreign policy issues are unifying Muslims, because one of the things that most Muslims agree on in the U.S. is that terrorism is one of their main sort of concerns. Overwhelmingly, about 90% of the Muslim American community points to terrorism overseas as a concern to them personally. Both because it impacts them as Americans, as Aubrey was saying. It impacts how other Americans are perceiving them. Now, on other issues, there's a little more disagreement. The recent Syrian conflict and refugee crisis is something that a lot of Muslims, not only those who are from the Middle East, but Muslims, you know, in general, have mobilized around. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is another issue that the community has mobilized around, although there's overwhelming support for a two-state solution. So again, it's a complicated picture. It's a mixed picture where you see some areas of, you know, cohesion and agreement and some areas of disagreement.
And Emily's work actually shows us the power of the recent elections in mobilizing the Muslim American community through their interest groups. And it seems that those interest groups worked toward getting out the Muslim vote, making the Muslims a visible political bloc, and engaging them in this climate of discrimination, really, and to push back against that discrimination in the current domestic climate, in addition to these foreign policy issues.
Well, so let's talk about that bloc or blocs. A lot of times with ethnic group lobbies, they do tend to end up in the same cities, even in the same neighborhoods, and so they can influence individual members of Congress or their state legislatures. Is that what you see in both voting blocs and lobbying?
In the case of Muslim American lobbying, we have a number of national level organizations. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, is the largest Muslim civic organization, right, working on these kinds of issues. There are others, MPACT, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and recently the U.S. Council on Muslim Organizations, which was established as an umbrella organization to try to bring some cohesion, not only to the community, but to these various local level organizations, community center, mosques that are trying to mobilize the community. So there's a lot of energy, and I think this is something that Aubrey brings up a lot in her work, that this diversity and this difference of opinions and practice, it's also very energizing.
Yes, and it's exciting for them to see their voices at the national level. It's a little more difficult, I think, at the subnational level mm-hmm. because, unlike many other minority groups, the Muslim American population is relatively spread out. There are concentrated Muslim communities in the United States, obviously outside Detroit and Dearborn and Houston and New York and Chicago, but they are increasingly spread out across the United States. So that makes mobilization difficult. It's a challenge. And they are only 1-2% of the American population. So there's a numbers issue in that regard.
This is a very important point. Public opinion data shows that most Americans think that the number is much higher, that there are 40 million. I've seen polls where Americans think that there are 40 million Muslims. And this goes to perceptions of threat, of immigrants coming and taking over, all these debates about Sharia law, which is also sort of this implicit Islamophobia that we're seeing emerging. So it's very important to highlight that, yes, they comprise a small minority, a meaningful minority, but nevertheless, about 1% of the total U.S. population.
And a diffuse minority.
Correct.
Which makes it harder to have electoral impact.
Yes.
Because they can't build in a particular community to
get a majority in any
elect
single
and unelect
no.
people, right? Yeah. Yeah, and campaign in that way.
Yeah. It's not unheard of, but it certainly is difficult.
Yeah, you can know. Be swing voters for sure.
And what the Muslim American organizations will tell you is that precisely it matters, because in places like Florida, Michigan, swing states, even though they're such a small number, they may be large enough to make a difference. So I think that's where a lot of the efforts are based.
Yes, some pundits called them the swing vote of 2016. So they are perhaps big enough in number in certain communities to make a real difference.
I just wanted to add that as we're speaking about the Muslim American community and their potential political impact, we also, I think, should keep in mind that it's not only about this 1% that we're directly referring to, but it's also about the coalitions that they're building. Mm. And that's something really important when we think about political impact.
What are the coalitions? You mean within the Muslim community or
both?
Beyond?
I would argue both.
What about beyond? What are the groups that they are primarily coalescing with?
Yeah. I think that what we saw emerging and really strongly in this election is interfaith dialogue and interfaith coalition building, in particular with the Jewish American community. Mm-hmm. The way I like to put it is that Islamophobia and anti-Semitism are really two sides of the same ugly coin. And I think both communities are increasingly aware of that and therefore working together to respond to this. I mean, most of the events taking place within the Muslim American community are taking place, the ones I've attended recently, are Jewish community centers, right? And I think there's a lot of potential there. Also, I mean, the African American community, the Latino community, and I think Aubrey's work also speaks to this very directly.
Aubrey?
Yes, we do find that you have these natural coalitions, especially among faith groups, where they are able to put aside historic differences, perhaps over the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and to come together in this domestic political climate for the same cause. And we see interesting co-optation of strategies, particularly of civil rights strategies in the Muslim community. Sometimes explicit comparisons made between civil rights strategies and the Muslim political strategies. They see their activism as firmly within the framework of American historic political participation. They see historic parallels to the situation that they're going through right now. And they use those connections to assert their Americanness and their right to stand up against the discrimination with their Jewish brothers and sisters.
You know, it almost sounds like there is an unseen unifying effect of Donald Trump rather than just a division effect. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. I mean, the fieldwork that I've done, right, speaking to members of the community, to leaders within the Muslim American community, you will hear this theme over and over again, that these elections have really woken us up. They have really mobilized us in a way that we haven't seen since the post 9/11 backlash. And this is a theme that I'm, at least in my work, explicitly hearing over and over again. So I think the real question will be how long, right? What will be the long-term impact, right? A year from now, 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. It remains to be seen.
And how long can you continue fighting when you feel that the establishment is working so hard to divide you and bring you down?
One of the things that you said earlier was that the Muslim American community looks very much like the average American voter in political behavior. Can we break down similarities and differences, would you, between, say, the Muslim American political groups versus other ethnic political groups? Is that possible?
The Muslim American community is generally better educated and financially more stable and higher income than other minority communities. So they come in with higher physical and political capital than other minority groups. Even so, they participate in voting, for example, at a rate slightly below that of Native Americans, but above other minority groups. So I think, again, it's hard to make generalizations because there are all sorts of demographic minorities within the Muslim community, but they are well situated to participate and do participate.
Emily?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And I think that also, if we look at the issues that they care about, they're very similar to the issues that the general American, you know, population cares about and that other minority groups care about. The economy is the number one issue for American Muslims. That's not surprising, right? Access to health care, right? Jobs. And what I find most interesting is that although a great majority, about 80% of them, are concerned about the direction that the country is going in, an equal number, right? So about an equal number of them, about 80%, also are satisfied with the ways their personal lives are going. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something really important to think about.
They have high life satisfaction,
yeah,
and they tend to be very optimistic about their prospects in this country. So they see themselves as being in a good place. In my research with focus groups, we spoke to women who often said, I feel that I am much better off here in the United States than I would be wherever my family came from. So there is that optimism and that engagement and that desire to be part of the American community that match Native Americans.
And they also very much believe in the American dream, the quote-unquote American dream. They will tell you overwhelmingly.
Don't tell them that it's dead.
Yes, overwhelmingly, they will tell you that if you work hard, you can make it in this country. And I think that's the energy that we see from immigrant communities in general, and we're seeing it from the Muslim American community in particular.
These days.
Sure. But one that is strong in mobilizing a lot of, you know, minority groups in particular.
And one that they think they've experienced in their family histories and in coming to this country.
What about party affiliation? Is there a tendency to move to one or the other?
Overwhelming.
Party?
Yes.
Okay, tell.
It wasn't, they were actually majority Republican before 9/11, but after 9/11, they moved overwhelmingly into the Democratic Party, but not without some discomfort. So the Muslim Americans I've talked to have said, I have real issues with some of the moral, social policies promoted by the Democratic Party, but I cannot imagine aligning myself with a party who uses Muslim Islamophobia as a political tactic. And so for them, that priority overwhelms their party affiliation, and they are overwhelmingly aligned with the Democratic Party. Although I will say that they also don't affiliate at about the same level as your average American. So about 30%, between 30 and 40% of Muslim Americans, they choose not to identify with a political party.
When you talk about the moral issues they find they can't align with in the Democratic Party, is that things like abortion choice and rights for gay people?
I think they would just more naturally align with the conservative social values represented by the Republican Party. But yes, I've had some research participants express discomfort with the what they perceive as morally loose platform, with platforms that allow for single parenthood, that don't promote what they perceive as nuclear family values, homosexuality, these kinds of things.
So it is sort of the traditional religiosity coming through.
Socially conservative is really the best way to describe, I think, their leanings. Although, yes, as Aubrey mentioned, in 2000 was the first time that we saw Muslim Americans voting as a bloc, and they voted overwhelmingly for George W. Bush. And in the following elections, that switched completely, where you saw over 80% of the Muslim American community voting for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So a very clear rupture in their party affiliation. Another interesting, I think, thing to think about, especially when we think about how they perceive these social values, is that these perceptions shift. They're not static. And their perceptions on issues, for example, LGBTQ issues, has shifted over the past few years, right? From 2012 until now, the data from Pew shows that they are becoming more accepting mm-hmm. of the LGBT community. It's a community that is very much in flux, as all communities are, and that's important to think of as we try to sort of, you know, place them.
Yes, you do find very pro-LGBTQ Muslims who align those interests with the civil rights mm-hmm, and civil liberties that they see themselves as fighting for. So they can be consistent in that and fight for rights for everyone, even if they religiously wouldn't adhere to those kinds of lifestyles.
And this is certainly what the Muslim lobby groups are doing.
Yes.
The Muslim organizations that I examine are certainly doing this, right? Promoting the rights of all marginalized communities, mm-hmm. highlighting how the promotion of their community's rights are intertwined mm-hmm. with the promotion of all marginalized people's rights. And I think that's an important strategy, right?
Yeah, building coalitions across those diverse groups.
Now, when you said they voted overwhelmingly for George Bush initially in 2000, and then when Barack Obama ran, they flipped over and went to Barack Obama, do we know now if they maintained the Democrat lean when Donald Trump ran?
Oh, yes. About two-thirds of the Muslim American vote in these past elections went for Hillary Clinton. So about 66% of Muslims voted for the Democratic candidate.
66%?
Yeah.
So there were still more than about a third that
they're unidentified. You still have about 15 to 18% who are Republican, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the rest who are sort of politically unidentified.
How do they make sense of affiliating themselves with the Republican when the head of the Republican Party is sort of anti-Muslim? How does that make sense?
Like with any voter, I think they have their priorities. Mm-hmm. And when they see their priority as perhaps the economy or yes. reducing the size of the government, they will vote for the Republican candidate. Others might prioritize anti-discrimination, and they won't vote for a candidate who's been seen to demonize their population. It depends on what your political priorities are. And like with any voter, yes. they'll vote based on those priorities.
And what about gender? I saw there was a paper on your panel on gender. Was it yours, Aubrey?
It was mine, but we changed the topic when the data didn't work out the way we expected it to.
Well, what did you expect? What did turn out?
We expected that we would see greater divergence in gendered behavior, gendered political behavior, and we didn't see great divergence along the lines of gender. The women in our sample weren't much different than the men in our sample when it came to their political behavior in the models that we were using. I hope to continue to explore this. We do see slightly lower rates at a descriptive level of female participation compared to male participation within the Muslim community. That's not unusual within socially conservative religious communities. So I don't know that there's a unique story to tell in the Muslim American community. But Muslim American women embrace norms of feminism and political activism, and they are especially active here in the United States, where you see women taking leadership roles in the mosques and asserting themselves in the public spheres. We have female Muslims running for office here. So they are a very engaged female community.
What about running for office? What are we seeing there?
So I think that these organizations began the past decade or 15 years, they have really focused their efforts on get out the vote campaigns, right? Registering Muslims to vote, teaching them about their civil rights and how they can make an impact in their communities. In recent years, they also began encouraging them to run for office. I think the community is realizing that as much as we vote for, you know, whichever candidate and try at the policy level to influence policy, we have to be in politics if we want to really have any real impact. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing, at least at the organizational level that I examine, very concerted efforts to encourage people to vote and to run for office.
Have you seen an increase in representation by people being elected from the Muslim American community?
And I haven't looked at it
precisely,
specifically. Yeah. And I think, you know, the cases are still low. In Massachusetts, there's a young politician, he's from MIT, a graduate from MIT, and he was recently elected at the local level for office. His name escapes me right now. And there are other cases.
But we have some in Congress.
A few in the House. And a senator.
Yes.
They're few in number, but when you consider the size of the population, it's actually
representative.
Yeah, I would say representative. Hmm. But these efforts are an effort to mainstream and normalize Muslim Americans in the eyes of the non-Muslim American community. So there's this real push to maybe disproportionately represent Muslim Americans, both in politics and in the media, where we're making a real effort, we see a real effort in these interest groups to put Muslims in very visible positions at the community level and at the national level.
When there are areas of disagreement, Syria, for example, or in the collaboration with the Jewish community on Israel and Palestine, how are those getting resolved? Or are they just being pushed aside for the sake of unity on something else?
I think there's a lot of exciting dialogue taking place, both within the Muslim American community and, you know, between the Muslim American community and these other minority groups. And I think that there's a lot of engagement. As I said before, there's a lot of energy. When you attend these events and you speak to, you know, American Muslims, you see in them sort of an eagerness, right, to build these bridges and to think in creative ways about not only the problems that they face, but the solutions. That's really, I think, the most encouraging thing. Mm.
I agree. I've read some testimonies that suggested that there was a general agreement to say, we'll put aside our differences mm-hmm. for now because we're in a critical moment. Mm-hmm. But now the hope is, since they've created this social capital, we'll be able to use it for these previously irreconcilable differences mm-hmm. and push this social capital forward so that we can reach some negotiated solutions or agreements, or at least continued yeah. coordinated efforts here in the United States.
Do you know if it's happening in other countries as well? I know you focus on the United States, but, you know, Muslim Americans here, but there are also European Muslims mm-hmm. integrating there. Do you yes. know if there's similar things happening?
This is actually one of my next research projects. We're looking at a comparative study of Muslim political behavior in 5 or 6 advanced industrial democracies. I suspect that we don't see quite the same thing. I think the American Muslim community is unique in its diversity and in its political positioning, and that creates special opportunities here in the United States that they don't have in the same way internationally. The Muslim communities are also much bigger in Europe. So the Muslim populations in France and Germany and the United Kingdom hover at around 10% of the population. That's a substantial minority group. So they may not need to build these coalitions or these bridges to the same extent that our Muslim American community needs to.
Yeah, and I would add to that I think that the context of the U.S. in particular is also very different to what we see, for example, in France. We are, you know, we spent a great deal of time discussing Islamophobia and anti-Muslim discrimination, very important issues. But we also, I think it's important to recognize that Muslims in the U.S. are very well integrated, as Aubrey said, socioeconomically, politically, in comparison to other, you know, countries, especially France, the UK. The U.S. context is much more positive, I would say. And
yes.
this allows them to sort of mobilize in more meaningful ways.
Yes, socioeconomically, the Muslim populations in Europe are disadvantaged relative to the native populations, but that is not the case here. In fact, Muslim Americans outperform your average American socioeconomically. And until 9/11, yeah. they were almost a model minority in their integration.
Well, Aubrey Westfall, Emily Corey, it's great to have you with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thanks.
Emily Corey Toma is a research fellow at Northeastern University's Middle East Center. And Aubrey Westfall is a professor of political science at Wheaton College.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.